as offerings to God. This fixation on sacrifice is not peculiar to the Judeo-Christian tradition, but can be found in almost all cultures that have possessed animals to sacrifice. Sacrificial killing, the eminent Swiss classicist Walter Burkitt tells us, is the basic experience of the sacred. Before war became a widespread and massive enterprise, it was probably through ritual killing that humans approached the experience of the transcendent. That's something larger than ourselves, which uplifts the patriot at a pro-war rally. Hence, for example, the linguistic link between the words that touch on holiness: sacred, sacrament, sacerdotal, sacrilege, and sacrifice, which denotes ritual violence. All are cognate with Sakleis or Sakleish, the ancient Hittite word meaning rite. Not all cultures have possessed animals they deemed suitable for sacrifice, and some anthropologists reserve the term sacrifice for herding peoples, like the ancient Hebrews and Greeks. But those cultures which lack appropriate animal victims often feature acts of self-mutilation, which, while not properly sacrifices in the classic Hebrew and Indo-European sense, are equally focused on bloodletting as a public spectacle. In Mayan culture, for example, human sacrifice and bloodletting were continuous and pervasive throughout the classic period, and the aim seems to have been less the life of the victim and more his blood, perhaps as the sustenance demanded by the gods. Even without accompanying rituals or acts of violence, the flow of blood is an arresting spectacle. The color alone demands attention and calls to mind violent acts of piercing or cutting, and the shocking sameness of all living creatures beneath the skin. Sacrificial rituals often seem, in fact, aimed at the production of blood, as much as at any other byproduct of death, including edible meat. Among the varieties of sacrificial killing, strangling and hanging are not unknown, but are far less common than methods productive of the flow of blood. Ancient Greek, Hebrew, and Hindu rituals feature elaborate attention to the handling of the victim's blood, which may be collected in a trough or chalice, daubed on the foreheads of those seeking the benefits of sacrifice, or even poured over the body of a person in need of purification. Mayan royalty threaded cords through their penises, or, in the case of queens, their tongues, as their assembled subjects watched in awe. In an annual sun dance, Blackfoot and Arapaho males of the American Plains tore their flesh open as they danced backward from a pole to which they were attached by thongs hooked into their chests. Men of traditional Hawaiian and Australian Aboriginal cultures ritualistically cut their penises in order to induce bleeding. Almost any body part, limbs, face, genitals, trunk, has been exploited in some culture as a source of ritual blood. Among the Gahukugana and the Garurumba tribes of Papua New Guinea, the nose was the favored organ. The boys undergoing initiation are brought to a river amid the shouts, chants, and flute music of warriors. There they are confronted by a group of masturbating men who wade into the river and stick sharp leaves up their own noses until they hemorrhage profusely. The initiates also induce nasal hemorrhage. They then spend a year in the men's hut, have little contact with women, and practice nose bleeding, vomiting, and flute playing. In the ancient world, according to Burkitt, the ritual of animal sacrifice was a profoundly gripping, even terrifying spectacle. First, there were complex preparations, often involving bathing and sexual abstinence on the part of the human participants. In ancient Greece, the rite itself began with a procession in which the sacrificial animal was led to the holy place where the altar had been set up, usually with the fire blazing on top of it. Water was then sprinkled on the animal, followed by a shower of barley grains. Hidden beneath the grains in the basket was the knife, which now lies uncovered. The leader in this incipient drama steps toward the sacrificial animal, carrying the knife, still covered, so that the animal cannot see it. A swift cut, and a few hairs from the brow are shorn and thrown into the fire. Now comes the death blow. The women raise a piercing scream, whether in fear or triumph, or both at once. The Greek custom of the sacrificial scream marks the emotional climax of the event, drowning out the death rattle. The blood is collected in a bowl and sprinkled on the altar stone. The animal is carved up and disemboweled. After a seer has studied them for omens, the entrails are cooked over the altar fire and eaten at once by the participants. The rest of the meat may be eaten later, with a portion going to the priest, priestesses, or other functionaries associated with the holy place. Among the ancient Greeks, nothing of any importance could occur, no decisions could be made, without the accompanying flow of sacrificial blood. Funerals required sacrifices, as did celebrations and homecomings, vows and agreements. Risky ventures, such as journeys and wars, could not be undertaken without sacrifices both to reveal the likely outcome and to win the support of the gods. During campaigns, the military leader served also in the priestly role of sacrificer. As historian John Keegan reports of Alexander the Great, "Bizarre though it seems to us, his day began with his plunging of a blade into the living body of an animal, and his uttering of prayer as the blood flowed." Calamities and misfortunes could, of course, be overcome only through the appropriate sacrifices. In fact, one of the major functions of the famed Delphic Oracle was to regulate the economy of sacrifice, to dictate which creatures had to be sacrificed, in what quantities, and to which gods, in order to achieve the desired result. Large animals, such as bulls, counted more than small ones, and quantity was another important measure of devotion. The historian Xenophon relates that, before a battle with the Persians, the Athenians had vowed to Artemis to sacrifice as many goats as they should kill Persians. But they could not find enough, so they resolved to sacrifice every year 500, and they do so still. The ancient Hebrews were equally obsessed with sacrifice. In his book, In the Shadow of Moloch, Martin Bergman points out that the Hebrews, who went to such lengths to distinguish themselves from their neighbors in other religious matters, had sacrificial rituals very similar to those of the Canaanites and other despised idolaters. Whole pages of the Old Testament are devoted to the enumeration and description of animal sacrifices in minute anatomical detail. In Leviticus, chapter 9, verses 3 and 4, for example, Moses prescribes a kid of the goats for a sin offering, and a calf and a lamb, both of the first year, without blemish, for a burnt offering. Also a bullock and a ram for peace offerings, and a meat offering mingled with oil. The fate of each resulting animal byproduct is described, down to the fat, the caul, the kidneys, the liver, and the rump. Animal sacrifice, Burkert tells us, was an all-pervasive reality in the ancient world. Hebrew sacrificial ritual resembled that of the Greeks, which in turn resembled that of the Egyptians and Phoenicians, the Babylonians and Persians, the Etruscans and the Romans. The names of the gods who were the recipients of the sacrifices varied from culture to culture, but the main elements of the ritual were everywhere recognizable and familiar to the ancients: the procession, the climactic throat slitting or beheading, the butchering, the examination of entrails, the ritual uses of the fresh blood, the burning or cooking of the remains. All these bloody rituals belong in the same broad category of socially sanctioned violence, where we might locate war, and appear to be speaking to some of the same concerns as war. Death is clearly among these concerns, as is the power to bring about death, to kill, or at least draw blood. If nothing else, both war and ritual bloodlettings are spectacular demonstrations of the human power to injure and kill. But there is another connection, suggested by René Girard, in his wonderfully imaginative Violence and the Sacred. He speculates that war and sacrifice may originally have served the same end: to damp down the aggressive energy, which could tear a community apart, and redirect that energy toward an external focus, the sacrificial victim, or the foreign enemy, in the case of war. Girard seems to assume the existence of an aggressive instinct, or at least tendency, which, left to itself, would lead to endless feuds and squabbling. The entire function of religion, he argues, is to redirect this violence outward. Religion, in its broadest sense, must be another term for that obscurity that surrounds man's efforts to defend himself by curative or preventative means from his own violence. But one does not have to accept the idea of innate aggressiveness to apply Girard's line of reasoning. The violent tendencies he postulates could just as well be the product of circumstance, the rebellious tendencies of a people oppressed by their chief or king, for example. In either case, the function of sacrifice would be to redirect the violence toward more socially acceptable targets. Instead of killing one another, or the king, the sacrificers, or their priestly representatives, ceremoniously kill the victim. The god to whom the sacrifice is offered is irrelevant, in Girard's view, a mere mythological gloss on the proceedings. What matters is the selection of a victim and his or her violent and public death. The sacrificial victim must be seen primarily as a scapegoat, Girard argues, citing the ancient Greek ritual in which a pauper who had been maintained at public expense, the designated pharmakos, or cure, was driven out of the city and possibly killed in order to ward off a calamity, such as plague, foreign invasion, or internal dissension. Even an animal could serve as the designated victim. The term scapegoat comes from the Yom Kippur ritual of heaping the sins of the people on the head of a goat, and then slaughtering the animal along with the memory of the sins. In the process, according to Girard, the old pattern of each against another gives way to the unified antagonism of all against one. Social cohesion is preserved at the expense of the unfortunate scapegoat. Thus, Girard speculates, war is merely another form of sacrificial violence, arising from the need to deflect internal strife outward. We see here the principle behind all foreign wars: aggressive tendencies that are potentially fatal to the cohesion of the group are redirected from within the community to outside it. Whether Girard is right or not about the historical functions of sacrifice, few would quibble with his insight that war has served, again and again, to promote acquiescence to the political status quo. In our own time, Americans credited the Gulf War with bringing us together. Serbian and Croatian leaders solved their people's post-communist economic discontents with an orgy of nationalist violence. World War I, at least temporarily, abolished the threat of internal class warfare within most of the belligerent nations. Socialism was tamed, and henceforth contained, within the familiar structure of the militaristic nation-state, in the form of that war's most notable product, the Soviet Union. Food for the gods. But Girard passes too quickly over the issue of the nature of the deity who is the recipient of the sacrifice. For herein lies an important clue to the human habit of sacralizing violence. Practitioners of sacrifice have interpreted the rite in a highly specific and concrete way. Sacrifice is the means by which humans feed the god or gods. The victim is in fact a meal. Thus, the Olympian gods savored the smell of roasting meat arising from the sacrificial altars, and, at least in the work of the ancient Greek comic poets, complained about the size of their share of the meat. The Aztec sun god would be extinguished without its steady diet of sacrificial human blood. The Mayan gods seem to have required blood for sustenance. Inca gods ate sacrificial llamas. Hawaiian gods smacked their lips at the sight of their intended victims. The Hebrew god was too ethereal to be imagined actually eating. But in the Bible, the divine fire sometimes spurts forth excitedly and literally consumes the flesh lying upon the altar. The Hebrew king David acknowledges Jehovah's carnal interest in the sacrificial ritual when he resolves at one point to set things right between himself and the deity by letting him smell an offering. Thus, the ritual of sacrifice reveals an almost universal attribute of the archaic deity to whom the sacrifices are offered. He or she is a carnivore. This deity may have many other attributes, as a parental figure, a judge, a leader in war. But the animals sacrificed are, in all cases, edible animals, at least in the view of the sacrificers. They are domestic animals like goats and sheep, or occasionally wild animals such as deer, but seldom anything deemed unappetizing, such as insects or lizards. In his Theory of Religion, Georges Bataille offers a rather high-flown explanation of why the victim should be edible. "One sacrifices what is useful," he writes, "precisely to lift that thing out of the realm of utility and into the realm of immanence." But the far more direct explanation is that the gods prefer a meal of meat. What, after all, turned Cain against Abel, and thus, according to the Bible, initiated the whole tragic cycle of intra-human violence? Cain, recall, was a farmer, and gave offerings of the fruit of the soil. Abel was a shepherd, and gave the firstlings of his flock. God much preferred the meat offerings and unabashedly favored Abel. Hence Cain's murderous envy. The philosophically respectable explanation is that Cain, like Job later on, was being taught a lesson in God's arbitrariness and the necessity of accepting his will, no matter what that will demands. But a couple thousand years ago, when this story was being recorded, God's behavior probably did not seem so arbitrary. He simply wanted meat. Humans, too, are carnivores, and it is humans, for the most part, who actually consume the sacrificial meat. The countless animals sacrificed in the Old Testament do not, from an unbeliever's perspective, go to waste. They become the Hebrews' dinner. Some portion of the dead animal goes to the priests who perform the sacrifice, another portion to the lay participants who contributed the animal. Yet another portion, usually something rather insubstantial like the smoke from the sacrificial fire, to the deity. Even so, tensions sometimes arose over the relative size of the portions allotted to humans and gods. In the book of Samuel, we find that wicked priests are taking too much, and even demanding the whole raw animal, instead of their proper share of the cooked remains. In some ways, the institution of blood sacrifice is little more than the prelude to a meal. Anthropologist Bruce Lincoln observes that in ancient Indo-European cultures, every offering is followed by a meal. And ritual sacrifice continued to serve a culinary function well into the modern era, sometimes shading over into unceremonious butchery. The Temple of Kali in 19th century Calcutta could handle 800 goats in 3 days, far more than Xenophon's Athenians could muster. The temple serves simply as a slaughterhouse, for those performing the sacrifice retain their animals, leaving only the head in the temple as a symbolic gift, while the blood flows to the goddess. The Great Temple at Jerusalem played a similar role in the lives of the ancient Hebrews, and the rituals of kosher slaughter remain as reminders of the thriving biblical tradition of animal sacrifice. No animal could be eaten without having suffered a ritual death, just as the laws of ancient Greek cities stipulated that all meat offered for sale had to have been produced by ritual slaughter. Similarly, among the contemporary reindeer-herding Chukchi people of Northeast Asia, there are no secular kills. Every animal sacrificed is eaten, and every animal that is eaten represents a ritual offering to the gods. If the gods demand more sacrifices than the herds can reasonably provide, the Chukchi give them fake reindeer fashioned out of tallow, pounded meat, crushed leaves, or even snow. But even though sacrifice is, in some sense, no more than an elaborate preliminary to a meal, analogous perhaps to saying grace, it contains an element of anxiety, which has usually been interpreted as guilt. The meat may be deemed necessary as food. The ritual killing may be deemed necessary if the meat is to be eaten at all. Yet still, there is uneasiness over the slaughter. Hubert and Maus, the renowned 19th-century historians of sacrifice, report that some rituals required apologies to the victim. Excuses might be made for the act. The animal might be mourned, as if it were a relative. The rest of the species the victim belongs to might be entreated not to seek revenge. The sacrificer himself might be punished. At Athens, the priest of the sacrifice of the Buffonia, where an ox was sacrificed, fled, casting his axe away. The purification which the sacrificer had to undergo resembled the expiation of a criminal. In an ancient Babylonian rite, the priest apologized to the severed head of the sacrificial bull, saying, "This deed was done by all the gods. I did not do it." Sacrifice was the core religious rite, but at the same time, according to Girard, it was understood to be a moral transgression, akin to murder. He opens Violence and the Sacred with the observation, "In many rituals, the sacrificial act assumes two opposing aspects, appearing at times as a sacred obligation to be neglected at grave peril, at other times as a sort of criminal activity entailing perils of equal gravity." The ritual of sacrifice legitimates the act of killing for meat. Yet somehow, the ritual is never quite enough. The killing has still occurred. It is always right there, at the center of the ritual. Hence the need for the charade of denials and apologies to the victim. Conversely, Girard implies the ritual would be nowhere near so awe-inspiring if it did not include the element of transgression, so thrillingly registered by the sacrificial scream of the Greek rite. But guilt toward the animal victim is only one possible explanation for the angst that seems to surround the sacrificial rite. There is an alternative explanation which hinges on the possibility, implicit in so many cultures' rituals of animal sacrifice, that the victim was once, or might someday be, not animal, but human. In the Hebrew and Greek traditions, myths preserve the notion that the original, and perhaps most desirable victim from the divine point of view, was in fact human, and that the animal victim is only a substitute. A ram replaces Isaac on the altar at the last minute. A deer may or may not have replaced Agamemnon's daughter, Iphigenia. In some cases of animal sacrifice, the victim is first feted as if it were human, dressed in human clothes, perhaps treated like a human child, even nursed by human females, in the case of infant bears designated as sacrificial victims by the Ainu of Japan. The people of Tenedos in ancient Greece would treat a pregnant cow as if it were a woman, and the calf, when it was born, would be dressed as a human child and sacrificed to Dionysius. Or, as we shall see in a later chapter, the victim may in fact be human. When the victim is human, or is an animal construed as a substitute for a human, the act of sacrifice takes on new meanings. The drama is heightened. A new frisson is introduced. Not that of transgression, but of menace. It is the intriguing equivalence of animals and man, Burkert suggests, as expressed in mythology in the metaphors of tragedy, but also in rituals of substitution, that casts the shadow of human sacrifice over all those holy altars in front of the temples. If this creature can be killed, and if this creature is somehow a stand-in for a human victim, then the spectator must wonder, why not me? Herodotus captures this anxiety in his story of Heracles in Egypt. The Greek hero arrives to great celebration. He is crowned and led in a procession to the altar, where he suddenly realizes that he is not the hero of the feast, but the victim, designated for the sacrifice. Fortunately, being a hero, he is able to massacre the entire assemblage and escape unharmed. In the sacrificial ritual, the spectator is invited to identify not only with the sacrificer wielding the knife, but with the helpless creature who is about to be served up to the gods. Thus, the ritual has a terrible lesson to teach, that from the point of view of a carnivorous deity, humans are also meat. 3. The true mark of the beast. First, men lived apart from each other, and no city existed. Because of this, they were destroyed by animals that were always and everywhere stronger than they. And their industry that sufficed to feed them was yet inadequate to fight against the wild animals. Plato. Ask about the origins of any aspect of human behavior, and science was, until very recently, likely to give a one-word answer. Hunting. Hunting, especially of large animals, is the activity that distinguishes prehistoric humans from other primates. Hence, according to the theory of human evolution that prevailed in the 1970s, hunting must be the reason for the distinction. Imaginative depictions of our prehistoric ancestors, as in museum displays, still invariably feature man the hunter, scanning the horizon with sharpened stick in hand. In this account of our origins, there is nothing mysterious about the human propensity for violence. Man, or anything worthy of the name, has always been a predator, a killer of animals and eater of meat. According to the hunting hypothesis, as it is known, prehumans emerged from the African forests into the savanna 2 to 3 million years ago, developed a taste for meat, and began to organize their lives around its acquisition. Supposedly, everything human followed from this carnivorous predilection. Gender roles were laid down by the impossibility of taking infants and children along on the hunt. The use of tools, or more narrowly, weapons, tightened hand-eye coordination and sharpened the hominid brain. The cooperation required for the hunt called forth speech and some of the earliest forms of social organization. Humans' distinctly avid sexuality evolved to keep the male hunter providers loyal to the child-bound females who waited at home for their share of the meat, and so on. Hunger was the original challenge. Meat was the answer, and all else followed from that. If violence was, almost from the beginning, the means of human survival, then, according to some advocates of the hunting hypothesis, it must be bred into our genes, an evolutionary version of original sin. This was the view of paleontologist Raymond A. Dart, who offered the following, somewhat overwrought, summary of the connection between Paleolithic hunting, sacrificial killing, and war. The blood-bespattered, slaughter-gutted archives of human history, from the earliest Egyptian and Sumerian records to the most recent atrocities of the Second World War, accord with early universal cannibalism, with animal and human sacrificial practices or their substitutes in formalized religions, and with the worldwide scalping, headhunting, body mutilating, and necrophiliac practices of mankind in proclaiming this common bloodlust differentiator, this predaceous habit, this mark of Cain that separates man dietetically from his anthropoidal relatives and allies him rather with the deadliest of carnivora. But theories of man the bloodthirsty carnivore do not account for the peculiar human tendency to sacralize the act of killing, to surround it with ritual and awe. There is a gap here, which scholars have sought to fill with specifically human feelings of altruism or guilt. In Walter Burkert's account, sacrificial ritual is rooted in the feelings of guilt human hunters must have felt toward their animal victims. The beginnings, one might imagine, of an admirable ecological consciousness. Humans needed to kill, this line of reasoning goes, but killing filled them with a deep unease. As historian of religion Karl Lueckert put it, for their sins of killing, primitive hunters developed and performed religious retreat rituals, primarily to alleviate feelings of guilt. They atoned for their trespasses. The evidence usually cited for such guilt among early humans is the elaborate arrangements of animal bones left in some sites by hunters of the Upper Paleolithic. These remains testify, Carl Moley argued in the 1940s, to the ritual aspects of animal killing, even in very distant times. The hunters, it has been inferred, must have worried that what they were doing was wrong. Although, as Burkert observes with a rueful, alas, some surviving hunting peoples are said to laugh at the convulsions of the dying animal. So the hunting hypothesis, plus some allowance for paternal responsibility and the supposed delicacy of human feelings, was made to account for everything. Hunting was believed to be the great triumph that lay at the threshold of human existence, and simultaneously, the original trauma. Humans are killers, according to this hypothesis, but somehow not natural killers, like lions or wolves. Only through the consolations of religion and ritual could our species sustain its bloody career. But in just the past 10 or 15 years, the hunting hypothesis has declined rather precipitously to the status of myth. Certainly big game hunting was, or at least became at some point, an important part of how prehistoric humans earned their livelihood. But the hypothesized status of hunting as the nearly exclusive factor driving human evolution is now thought to be grossly overstated. It had always seemed a bit suspicious that the sexual division of labor postulated by the hunting hypothesis, with the males striding out to hunt while the females remain home with the young, bears such an uncanny resemblance to that of American suburbanites in the mid-20th century, when the framers of the hunting hypothesis were coming of age. It is at least unlikely, as Donna Haraway argues, that an exclusively male activity, if hunting was indeed that, could have been the sole motor of human evolution. In fact, studies of existing hunting-gathering societies suggest that it may have been the presumably male activity of hunting, rather than the female work of gathering, which should be regarded as a supplemental activity. Proud hunters, like the Kung people of the Kalahari Desert, derive only a fraction of their calories from hunting. The rest come from the gathering activities undertaken mainly by women. Similar proportions hold for other hunting-gathering cultures, except those in the plant-poor Arctic region. Furthermore, careful re-examination of the archaeological evidence in a number of sites has led to the conclusion that hominids and even early Homo sapiens were more likely to obtain the meat they did eat by scavenging the kills left by more effective predators, such as the big cats, than by hunting for themselves. Big game hunting, as opposed to scavenging, may be a fairly recent innovation. Going back, in anthropologist Lewis Binford's estimation, to no more than 70 to 90,000 years ago. So if we want our theories of human culture to be based firmly on material need, it might be better to start with woman the gatherer, or man and woman the scavengers of carrion, than with man the hunter. But for our purposes, the real problem with the hunting hypothesis is that it completely obscures an aspect of the human-animal relationship which may have been far more important in shaping human evolution. Humans, and before them, hominids, could not always have been the self-confident predators depicted in the standard museum diorama. The savanna that our hominid ancestors strode, or more likely, crept warily into, was populated not only by edible ungulates, but by a host of deadly predators, including a variety of big saber-toothed cats, as well as the ancestors of lions, leopards, and cheetahs. Before, and well into the age of man the hunter, there would have been man the hunted. Advocates of the hunting hypothesis, and there certainly remain some, have tended to poo-poo the threat of predation to early humans. Man, the archaeologist and popular writer Louis Leakey proclaimed, is not cat food. Until recently, big cat predation on primates of any kind was thought to be the work of rare pathological individuals who were too disabled or demented to catch their normal prey. Besides, whether or not primate meat is distasteful to carnivores, the thought of being eaten is definitely distasteful to us. But the evidence of predation, both on hominids and on modern primates, has become overwhelming. The turning point came in the early 80s with the re-examination of certain hominid bone deposits found in southern Africa. For years, these assemblages of hominid and animal bones had been interpreted in the light of the hunting hypothesis. The reason why the hominid bones were commonly found intermixed with those of other animals, according to Raymond Dart, was that Australopithecus, who lived 750,000 years ago, had hunted and killed the other animals. Dart's follower, Robert Ardrey, went further. Australopithecus was a murderer, as well as a hunter. The wounds found in one of the hominid skulls were evidence, he argued, of purposeful armed assault. And so it went, until the South African paleontologist C.K. Brain did a little further detective work. He measured the puncture marks in the skull of the supposedly murdered Australopithecus and found that the distance between them precisely fit the gap between the lower canines, or stabbing teeth, of the leopard. The reason, he argued, that hominid and animal remains so often ended up together was that both had been eaten by leopards. Hominids and prehistoric humans were almost certainly never numerous enough to constitute the sole foodstuff of any predator species. But even if no other species specialized in predation on early humans, our biology is alone enough to suggest an alarming level of vulnerability to the exceptionally hungry or casual prowler. Humans and primates, generally, with the exception of the muscular gorillas and certain baboons, are individually, and in the natural unarmed state, rather dainty creatures. Compared to the big cats, our teeth are blunt, our muscles weak, our nails good for little more than scratching away at lice. Nor do we have the natural defenses possessed by other large land animals: the elephant's thick skin, the buffalo's horns, the antelope's speed. Until recently, though, predation on primates was downplayed because primatologists seldom witnessed it. There was, as it turns out, a good reason for this. Primatologists do their work in the daytime, while predators tend to do theirs at night. More careful observations, including the analysis of carnivore feces for primate remains, have established that predation is indeed a serious threat to modern primates, and was most likely to ancient ones as well. A 1991 study found that leopard predation was the number one cause of death among a forest chimpanzee population, accounting for 39% of deaths over a 5-year period. 2 years later, evidence was reported for significant lion predation on chimpanzees. Field observations suggest that troops of savanna-based baboons, which are sharp-toothed, formidable fighters, lose 25% of their members to predation annually. If primatologists have not always appreciated the threat of predation, primates certainly have. Savannah-dwelling chimpanzees, which share their habitat with lions, cluster in large groups, presumably for defense, and use alarm calls to warn of approaching predators. Similarly, baboons enter the savanna warily, falling into a defensive marching order, with the young males on the periphery. A sick baboon will try so hard to keep up with the group that it will neglect to find food, and thus weaken all the more quickly. For an individual to fall behind the troop is to be eaten within hours after the troop has gone, and probably before its heart stops beating. Reviewing the evidence for carnivore predation on non-human primates, the Dutch biologist Adrian Cortland concludes that, for the early hominids, breaking a leg while walking alone would often have been fatal due to carnivore predation. Modern Homo sapiens, too, can be tasty prey. Despite the conventional wisdom that wild predators do not like the flesh of primates or will not attack unless bothered. Wild carnivores have been a threat to human communities right into historical times. In our own time, most of the large predators have become endangered species, and this has led to an understandable tendency to see them as victims rather than as victimizers, and of no great danger to respectful humans. Hikers are routinely reassured that the ambient wildlife will not bother them if they refrain from bothering it. But there have been a number of cases in recent years alone of attacks on humans by apparently undisturbed predators. Mountain lions attacking joggers, for example, or bears attacking sleeping campers. Some of these attacks can perhaps be rationalized as unnatural behavior resulting from too much contact with humans or with the waste left at human campsites. But clearly some predators in some settings do in fact stalk humans as food. The tigers of the Sundarbans are an undeniable example, and have even been known to modify their behavior in response to the evasive tactics of humans. In 1986, realizing that tigers almost never attack a human from the front, someone designed plastic face masks to be worn on the back of the head. The masks fooled the tigers for 5 or 6 months, after which the tigers figured out that the masks were not faces at all, and resumed their attacks. One of the few systematic studies of carnivore predation on humans, conducted near the Gir Forest of Western India between 1978 and 1991, found up to 40 lion attacks on humans per year, forcing the unhappy villagers to remain indoors after sunset or go out only in groups of 4 or 5. Lions significantly impeded the construction of the Ugandan Railway in 1895 to 1901, killing 28 Indian laborers and about 100 African villagers living near the construction sites. Surviving laborers were forced to set up camp on top of water towers, dig pits beneath their tents, or sleep in beds lashed to trees. Tigers, far more than lions, have restricted human opportunities in the Indian subcontinent. According to Franklin Russell's The Hunting Animal, when the British East India Company received its charter from Elizabeth I in 1600, many thousands of square miles, some said 500,000, of India were depopulated by tigers. Farmers, after establishing crops, grazing animals, residences, and roads, were driven from their lands by tigers, the stock destroyed, their workers taken in the fields, and their families plucked from out of their residences. Travel on roads was impossible without either firearms or great numbers of travelers banded together. The British started recording the numbers of humans lost to tigers in 1800 and found that by the end of the century, approximately 300,000 people had been killed, along with 6 to 10 million farm animals. In the Sundarbans region of India, where the tigers routinely stalk humans as food, even today, so many are killed by tigers here that some villages are known as Vidava Palis, tiger widow villages. Arampas, near Gosaba, is one such village. In each of its 125 families is a woman whose husband or brother or son was killed by a tiger. Today, most large land carnivores are either extinct or too wary of firearms to attack a group of humans, or so at least the conventional wisdom goes. But individuals still fall prey to alligators, bears, mountain lions, and packs of hyenas or wild dogs. Among the more lurid 20th century cases of predation on humans cataloged by C.K. Brain is a leopard in Rudraprayag, India, that killed 125 people between 1918 and 1926, even in one instance, forcing open a door to get to a boy sleeping inside. A Zambian leopard killed 67 people in 1936 to 1937, and, according to Brain, some African villages practiced a grisly form of euthanasia by leaving old, sick, or feeble individuals outside the village at night so that animals would dispose of them. People living in the perfect safety of their homes in a Western country have no conception of the insecurity felt by blacks in their kraals in the interior of Africa. A white hunter, James Sutherland, wrote in 1912. The cause of this feeling of insecurity is chiefly the man-eating lion, and no other animal of the forest inspires such terror. In villages far in the heart of the Puri, where the white man is never seen, not hundreds but thousands of Africans are killed annually by these monsters. Wolves, it is often claimed, never attack humans. But in the summer of 1996, the Indian state of Uttar Pradesh experienced 33 fatal wolf attacks on children and 20 maulings. As the New York Times reported, when the man-eating wolf came into this tranquil village, Bhanbarpur, toward dusk on an evening in mid-August, it was every child's worst nightmare come true. The wolf pounced, while Urmila Devi and three of her eight children were in a grassy clearing at the edge of the village. The animal, about 100 pounds of coiled sinew and muscle, seized the smallest child, a four-year-old boy named Anand Kumar, and carried him by the neck into the luxuriant stands of corn and elephant grass that stretched to a nearby riverbank. When a police search party found the boy 3 days later, half a mile away, all that remained was his head. In the Paleolithic setting, humans, or hominids, would not have had to be any animal's favorite meal in order to be thrust into constant conflict with predators. For one thing, as we will see in Chapter 7, the population of predators, and indeed of all large land animals, was much larger in the Paleolithic period than it has been ever since. Furthermore, if early humans obtained their meat primarily by scavenging, they would have been drawn again and again to the kill sites left by more successful hunting animals, where there was always the possibility of the predator's return. Leopards and lions will fight any poachers they discover at their kill sites. Wild dogs or hyenas, for example, and unarmed hominids would have been easily driven off or even added to the predator's meal. Though scavenging may be a sinecure compared to hunting for oneself, it is hardly a low-risk occupation. Yet somehow it offends human vanity to think of ourselves or our predecessors as vulnerable prey, potential meat for other species. Darwin himself glided right over the problem of human vulnerability. On one page in The Descent of Man, he calls man the most dominant animal that has ever appeared on Earth. 20 pages later, he acknowledges that if hominids had been any stronger, they would probably have failed to become social, and this would most effectually have checked the acquirement by man of his higher mental qualities. Hence, it might have been an immense advantage to man to have sprung from some comparatively weak creature. But a comparatively weak creature could not have become the most dominant animal overnight. Here is what we might call the missing link within the theory of human evolution itself, how a poor shivering creature grew to unquestioned dominance. Before, and well into the age of hunting, there must have been a long dark era of fear when the careless and the stragglers were routinely picked off, when disease or any temporary weakness could turn a man into meat. It is not only vanity which has kept us from acknowledging the tragic vulnerability of our predecessors. There is a special conceit that we tend to bring to any contemplation of primitives, contemporary or prehistoric. We have a bias against believing that primitives also experience history and change. We imagine that whatever we find them doing at the moment of contact or excavation is what they must have been doing for untold thousands of years. As if there could be no migrations, no catastrophes, no innovations, until we moderns arrive on the scene. But prehistory was not one blank smooth screen on which the same actions, hunting, dragging the carcass back to camp or cave, sharing the meat, and so forth, were enacted over and over. The very notion of prehistory is simply an admission of our ignorance of what had to have been an immensely complex and varied history. Glaciers came and went, forcing early humans to migrate or invent new ways of living. The outlines of continents changed. Land bridges appeared, as between Asia and North America, or Australia and Tasmania, only to vanish again under impassable seas. Human technologies were also changing. The first evidence of artificial fire making, an iron pyrites ball with deep grooves from repeated striking, comes from a Belgian site only 15,000 years old. And it was only about 15,000 years ago that our ancestors developed effective, action-at-a-distance weapons, like the bow and arrow, that did so much to make our species the most dominant animal on Earth. So, we could say, without disrespect to the known facts, that there were at least two broad and overlapping epochs in prehistory, one in which our ancestors confronted the world, for the most part, as potential prey, and another in which they took their place among the predators which had, for so long, oppressed them. An epoch of cowering and perpetual vigilance, and an epoch in which other species learned to cower and flee from us. The transition from one status to the other would have been halting and gradual, as the means of defense, both weapons and forms of social organization, evolved into the means of attack and offense. And well into the epoch of man the hunter, humans still had good reason to fear the tall grass, the forests, and the night. But there was a transition, and even if Darwin could not bring himself to think of it, it had to be the single greatest advance in human evolution. This progress our distant ancestors made from the status of anxious prey to that of unrivaled predator. We were not given dominion over the earth. Our forebears earned it in their long, nightmarish struggle against creatures far stronger, swifter, and better armed than themselves, when the terror of being ripped apart and devoured was never farther away than the darkness beyond the campfire's warmth. If we seek an original trauma that shaped the human response to violence, we have no need to postulate some primal guilt over hunting and killing. The original trauma, meaning, of course, not a single event, but a long-standing condition, was the trauma of being hunted by animals and eaten. Here, most likely, lies the source of our human habit of sacralizing violence, in the terror inspired by the devouring beast, and in the powerful emotions associated with courage and altruism that were required for group defense. Animals and human evolution. We are unaccustomed to thinking of animals as anything other than instruments of human ambition, or at best, as pets. They occur in history buried within adjectives modifying forms of human culture. There have been herding peoples, hunting peoples, horse peoples, with the adjectival status of the animal emphasizing its total subordination to human needs. Or, what is worse, urban people in the industrialized North have almost ceased to think of animals even as useful servants and find them merely cute. Bears have been trivialized as teddy bears. The mighty dinosaurs have been given witty television personae. In children's books, the animals speak and play human roles to evoke a whole world of cuteness. It is almost beyond us to think of animals as actors in their own right, following their own agendas, much less as actors which might have shaped the course of human destiny. But animals played a much more vivid and active role in the primitive or ancient human mind. The modern reader is often baffled by the predominance of animals in the art and myths of our progenitors. Paleolithic cave art features masterfully drawn animals: bison, rhinoceroses, bears, deer, aurochs, lions, interacting with humans, who are often no more than stick figures and sometimes dressed with bird or stag heads themselves. The earliest civilizations worshipped hybrid human-animal gods, like Sekhmet, the lion-headed Egyptian goddess of war. The intricate geometric ornamentations in ancient Chinese art turn out to be animals, mostly, in fact, sacrificial animals, in abstract form. In the Hindu pantheon, Ganesh still takes the form of an elephant, Hanuman, a monkey. Even the highly anthropomorphic Greek gods have their animal familiars, like Demeter and her pigs, and it may be that the animal was the form the deity originally took. In myth and folklore, there is no sharp, clear boundary dividing animals from humans. Animals can become humans or human-like gods, and vice versa. Just as frogs turn into princes in European fairy tales, Zeus becomes a swan in order to rape Leda. Actaeon is transformed by Artemis into a stag. Men, as we have seen, can become wolves or bears on their way to being warriors. Quite aside from all this shape-changing, the human and animal protagonists of myth interact promiscuously and with no regard for genetic compatibility. Pasiphae, the mythical Cretan queen, has sex with a bull and gives birth to the monstrous Minotaur. The deer woman of Plains Indian mythology sneaks off at night from her human brothers to mate with bucks and give birth to fawns. In the Hindu epic, the Mahabharata, Rama calls on the gods to mate with the wives of the foremost of monkeys and bears in order to produce a generation of superhuman warriors who have the strength of the elephant and the speed of the wind. All of this comes to us from a world that is almost impossible to imagine today, a world in which humans were everywhere decisively outnumbered by large land animals and lived in intimate connection with them. Even in Homer's age, when humans had already domesticated the large edible animals and subdued many of the wild predators, domesticated animals provided food, clothing, and various byproducts. Teams of sweating oxen reduced the farmer's labor in the fields, and the dog kept off human and animal robbers. Many shared, like Eumaeus, a bed in common with their domesticated animals. Beyond the cultivated areas, wild animals, rabbit, deer, and the boar, provided sport for the huntsman and his hounds, and trained adolescents for war. On the peripheries lived the cattle robbers and scavengers, the lion and the jackal, who preyed on men's cattle and ease of mind. But of all the animals that populate myth, none have more forceful and active roles than the fighting animals which represent a danger to humans, the large horned ungulates, and especially the predator beasts. The Hindu goddess Durga saves the entire pantheon of gods by defeating the buffalo demon. The Greek hero Heracles battles the Nemean lion. Theseus subdues giant boars, as well as the bull-headed Minotaur. And what are we to make of the fantastic zoology of ancient myth? The dragons and sea monsters and beastly amalgams of familiar animals. Probably the single most universal theme of mythology is that of the hero's encounter with the monster that is ravaging the land or threatening the very foundations of the universe. Marduk battles the monster Tiamat. Perseus slays the sea monster before it can devour Andromeda. Beowulf takes on the loathsome, night-feeding Grendel. A psychiatrist might say that these beasts are projections of the human psyche, inadmissible hostilities deflected to mythical targets. But it might be simpler, and humbler, on our part, to take these monsters more literally, as exaggerated forms of a very real other, the predator beast, which would at times eat human flesh. Myth may represent the oldest and crudest form of history, shot through, of course, with fantasy. The next refinement, which brings us closer to the actual historical record, is the epic tale. And here, too, the beasts abound. Enkidu, comrade of Gilgamesh in the Sumerian epic, has the job of protecting human settlements from animal marauders. He took his weapon to chase the lions, that shepherds might rest at night. He captured wolves. He captured lions. The chief cattleman could lie down. Enkidu is their watchman, the bold man, the unique hero. In Homer's world, humans have far more to fear from one another than from predator animals. But still, it is the beast that defines ferocity. Similes compare warriors to hounds, wild dogs, lions, or men confronting lions. In the Iliad, We even get a glimpse of a time when men went to war, not against one another, but against the wild beasts. Achilles attacks Aeneas, we are told, like a lion, who men, when a whole community has gathered itself, are furious to kill. Perhaps the saddest theme of the whole blood-drenched epic is Achilles' transformation from a beautiful young hero into a kind of cannibal beast himself. At the close of the climactic battle, he refers to his dying enemy Hector as meat rather than flesh, and wishes that his own appetite were stronger. "I wish only that my spirit and fury would drive me to hack your meat away and eat it raw." Moving closer to what might be called the historical record, we can still find evidence of humankind's war against the predator beasts. A stele erected by the Assyrian king Assurbanipal in the 7th century BC recounts the ferocity of the lions and tigers after torrential rains had flooded the land. The inscription boasts of his efficiency in stamping out these beasts in their lairs. In the Old Testament, which certainly reflects some historical events, lions are a common menace. Samson killed a lion, and God sent lions among the Assyrians when they occupied Samaria, killing many of the invaders. As late as the 5th century BC, Herodotus reports lions attacking Xerxes' pack camels during a march through Thrace. And it may be that the walls built around early human settlements, such as those supposedly erected by Gilgamesh, were meant not only to foil human foes, but to keep out predators and stampeding wild herds as well. Defense against animals might also explain the peculiar design of the Anatolian Neolithic community, Çatal Huyuk. There are no walls around the town, but the entrances of dwellings all lead out through the roof. Easy enough for a human enemy to penetrate, but probably baffling to lions and wild bulls. There are other reasons to think that wild animals were still perceived as menaces by the ancients in their cities and towns. Classicist Christopher A. Ferroni points out that frightening images of dogs, lions, and monsters were commonly posted at the entrances of temples or cities to ward away evil. And one of the evils they were meant to repel was beasts like themselves. He cites a Hebrew manuscript from the 3rd or 4th century AD, and reflecting, he says, far earlier traditions, advising, "If you wish to expel from the city every dangerous wild animal, whether lion or wolf or bear or leopard, make a bronze image in the likeness of the one which you desire to expel, and bury it at the entrance of the city, and let its face be facing north." This concern made sense, he argues, in very early agricultural communities in the eastern Mediterranean, where the sudden and devastating attack of actual predators, wolves, wild dogs, bears, lions, on men and livestock, was a real and vivid possibility. But we do not have to look so far back in time to find traces of the marauding beast, faint paw prints left deep in the human psyche. Children's first nightmares are often of devouring beasts. Their most thrilling games are of capture and pursuit. Their bedtime stories feature cannibal witches and wolves intent on human flesh. A 1933 study of urban children's fears found high frequencies of fear of animals and hybrid animal-human monsters. And this, before television had brought monsters into every living room. A later study of American school children in 1965 found them not much concerned about practical threats like nuclear war, traffic, and germs. The strange truth, concluded the author of the study, is that they fear an unrealistic source of danger in our urban civilization: wild animals. In response to the question, what are the things to be afraid of? 80% of children ages 5 and 6 mention wild animals, predominantly snakes, lions, tigers, and bears. Similarly, studies of dreams reported by urban adults show a surprising prevalence of menacing animals, given their virtual absence in real life. Japanese and American college students, for example, reported high frequencies of dreams involving creatures, part human, part animal, wild, violent beasts, snakes, and being frozen with fright. Subconscious preoccupations, which biologist Balaji Mund Kerr speculates, may reflect basic sensitivities imprinted during the psychological evolution of primates. The defense hypothesis. Once we acknowledge that our distant ancestors were prey as well as predators, we can imagine human evolution being driven not only by appetite, but by the imperatives of defense. The evolution of human intelligence, for example, has often been credited almost entirely to cooperative big game hunting, with its requirements of communication and weapon use. But obviously, defense would have also required insight, cooperation, and new technologies. In fact, Johns Hopkins paleobiologist Stephen M. Stanley has recently proposed that the turning point in hominid evolution came when climactic changes pushed our ancestors out of the trees and into the predator-infested savanna. It was, he argues, the need